You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
This episode is brought to you by Mubi. What's up, everybody? Welcome to Show Me the Meaning, Wisecrack's movie podcast.
Show me the meaning!
I'm Jared, and with me is the Show Me the Meaning crew. We got Ryan.
Hey, film fans, what's up?
And Austin.
What up? I'm here for some wanky nonsense.
And joining us for the first time in a while, fresh off the Westworld podcast, is Claire.
Hello.
Welcome back, Claire.
Thanks. I'm so excited to be back. I love Gone Girl so much.
Yeah, how's your summer going? I've been noticing you've been doing a lot of stuff with bunnies and rock climbing.
Yes. I was bunny sitting. The bunny has gone back to his original owner, but he was real cute. Oh, cutest bunny. Yeah, that pretty much sums up my summer. Bunnies, rock climbing, grading papers, something about a dissertation or who knows.
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah, we can skip that part.
Yeah. Yeah. How are you all doing?
We're doing good. Just trying to survive the LA heat, waiting for it to go away.
It's too hot, Claire.
Yeah, it's too hot.
Oh.
Anyway. So today we're breaking down the 2014 film Gone Girl, directed by David Fincher, written by Gillian Flynn, starring Ben Affleck and Rosamund Pike. As always, let's go ahead and get some first impressions. Let's start with Ryan.
This is top shelf Fincher, I think.
Hell yeah,
I love it. I loved it when it came out. I think, and it's one of those movies that really does, there's a little bit of a mystery box element to it that you pick up on new stuff the more you watch it. I mean, I liked it way more the second time I saw it than the first time I saw it, and then it's just gotten better. So I love this movie.
How many times have you seen it?
Excited to talk about it. I want to say about half a dozen, six or so.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Let's go with the guest, Claire.
So I am a Gone Girl book diehard fan. So the first time, you already know, you can like predict about 3/4 of the upcoming podcast based on what I just said. but the first time I saw the movie, my first reaction was, oh, this isn't like the book at all. And I was kind of disappointed, which is why I basically begged you to let me be on the podcast, because I've been thinking about it since it came out. I see clips every once in a while, and, you know, I've read the book again several times, and it's kind of been slowly building up to the realization that everyone else had back when it came out that, hey, this is not supposed to be the same thing as the book. This is a very different, it's a different kind of thing. So the last time I was on this podcast, we were doing Eyes Wide Shut. And in a lot of ways, the second time I did the full watch through, which was in the last few days for this podcast, honestly, in some ways it resembles like Eyes Wide Shut or another Fincher film more than it resembles the book. And I'm really okay with that. And I like the movie for what it is now, which I didn't the first time I saw it. So now I'm excited about the movie as the movie and not just the movie as what wasn't the book.
And notably, it's the screenplay was written by the author of the book, which
is and that's amazing.
Unheard of, kind of.
It's unheard of. The only other time I can think of that is Anne Rice wrote the adaptation for Interview with a Vampire. But any time an author is able to distance themselves from their own work enough to create something for a different medium and it turn out good is super impressive.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Playwrights do it all the time, like David
Mann. Oh, yeah, the guy
Neil
who
LaBute,
wrote...
Neil LaBute does it all the time.
Martin McDonough.
Who's the guy who wrote Doubt?
Oh, I don't remember that.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Flannery?
That guy. Something Irish.
Yeah.
All right, Austin, what do you think about this movie?
Tracy Letts, too, is another one. Anyway, keep going.
Meh? Eh? For me?
You don't like
You're fucking kidding me.
Eh? Like,
is this your first time? Is this your first time?
It's all right. It's middle tier Fincher for me, if I'm going to use Ryan's verbiage. Yeah.
Middle tier Fincher, huh?
Yeah. Really? You know, it's in there with Social Network for me.
Well, that's top tier Fincher.
Yeah, I mean, Fincher just might be ridiculously tiered, but like, what is top tier for you?
Fight Club.
That's it?
That's fair. I mean,
yeah, I mean, it's hard to say because anything that Fincher does is good, right? So it's like I even just recently watched Death Proof, which I think is not a good movie. But then wait, it's Tarantino, bro. It's not a good movie, but it's not a good Tarantino movie. Is it just like not a good movie? I don't know. It's hard because the scale gets so out of whack. Because I think obviously Fincher is more than a competent technician, and then he's a very intriguing filmmaker, and he's a masterful craftsman, and he's a perfectionist. So there are all those things that I think you can see in the thing that's created. But two things. The first time I saw it, the twist was really fun. It was really surprising. Now, when you know the twist, that takes a lot out of it, right? So for me, I think that's something that's detrimental on repeated viewing. For me. Oh, so for me it was. And then I think that Rosamund Pike's performance for me actually was overpraised so much. I thought that there was this intention to be extremely sleek and cool and sexy that just didn't work very well for me on the second viewing. I actually really liked it the first viewing. Second viewing, I'm kind of like, meh.
Did you, Austin, you intentionally use the word cool. Are you, and I think maybe we can talk about this later with the cool girl speech, the pretty infamous cool girl speech, but that seems like a pretty critical part of it to me. But
yeah, Austin.
Yeah, I have a lot of things to say, including I will fight you about Death Proof.
Oh, really? That's not what I was expecting her to say.
I hate that movie.
Dude, I'm excited. This is going to be like Austin's Cabin in the Woods, because I hated Cabin in the Woods, and I fucking love this movie. This is maybe even top Fincher to me. I think this is the most relevant movie ever. I watched this movie 10 out of 10, ran home, ran to Amazon, ordered the book, read the book, loved the book, 10 out of 10. Ran to my DVD collection, watched the movie again, 10 out of 10. And I've loved the fuck out of this movie every single time. I mean, I don't know. I tend to focus a lot on, you know, the way that narrative affects our lives. I mean, as somebody who, at Wisecrack, we study narrative, so the way that narrative has kind of informed the way that we interact with each other and the way that we can construct our own identities and interpret other people's identities is something that I think is so important that people talk about, and I think is so interesting. And of course, the way that the media affects us and even constructs reality.
Perception is everything.
We talked about that on the Incredibles 2 podcast, so you know that this is the stuff that gets my heart beating. So it's only reasonable that I would love the shit out of this movie. Plus, I think that this is kind of one of the coolest Ben Affleck performances, because it's not often that you see Ben Affleck playing like the guy who is initially the super good-looking jock guy, but under the facade, he's just kind of a lazy schlub.
This is honestly one of my favorite Ben Affleck performances, mostly because of how un-Ben Affleck-y he is. He reminds me of the Ben Affleck you read about in tabloids, which is perfect.
Yes, exactly.
But not the Ben Affleck who's like Batman.
Right. He seems like a guy who has got a lot going for him, but is just kind of an alcoholic who's depressed all the time. maybe I just got too real with Ben Affleck. But anyway. All right. Before we go on to the summary, I want to give a shout out to some of the very, very kind, awesome people who left us a review on iTunes. So once again, if you guys have the time, it really helps us to grow and really helps us keep things going here if you just spend a couple minutes giving us a review. So this one's from Izzy194. He says, "They have all kinds of intellectual discussions about media that I wish I was still having. Since graduating college, I miss hearing these kinds of ideas on a weekly basis, and this podcast remedies that." Well, thank you, Izzy. This next one is from Tenacious Dustin. "Like all of Wisecrack's online content, this podcast does an amazing job looking at current and classic films, their themes, philosophy, and meaning." Thank you so much, Tenacious Dustin. This one is called "Nicknames Aren't Relevant." He said, "This is a great podcast. If you're looking for more of your favorite films, it'll also expose you to films you may not have known otherwise." So thank you guys so much for leaving us reviews. And if you guys haven't done it yet, I highly recommend it. All right, so let's go on with the recap. So Nick Dunn is lamenting his 5-year anniversary when he learns that his wife Amy has gone missing. The police peg him as their prime suspect, but Nick suspects something is weird when he finds a series of clues his wife left behind before her, quote, disappearance. Intercut with this, we experience the story of Amy and Nick's meeting and marriage through the point of Amy's diary. What started as a fairy tale romance descended into shit when they both lose their jobs and move back to Nick's hometown in bumfuck Missouri, where Nick's frustration eventually leads him to hitting her and her feeling afraid for her life. Nick follows all her clues when it's revealed that Amy is not dead. She faked her death and meticulously planted evidence to point to Nick as the killer in order to exact revenge for cheating on her, taking her money, and discarding her. Amy gets mugged and has to take refuge with a rich ex-boyfriend, Desi Collins. Meanwhile, Nick lawyers up and wins over the media's favor. After seeing Nick kill it on TV, Amy frames Desi as her captor and kills him. Amy returns to Nick, impregnates herself, and blackmails him into starting a family with her. End of movie.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
All right, so right up top, I think let's talk about narrative. Let's talk about what this movie does, not only with media, but also identity.
David Fincher says that if you split it up into three, it's like a perfect mystery movie for the first act, then it's moves into a real thriller for the second act, and the third act is it becomes a satire. What do you think about that?
A satire? Why a satire?
Well, that's David Fincher's words. You'd have to ask him. Well, but I mean,
but you seem to agree. So I'm wondering,
at the end, it's about kind of like Jared was saying. It's relevant about perception is everything, about how the media, the current media landscape. It's about our times now. All that matters is what you see in the tabloids, and people create their own narratives, what they want from there. So.
Yeah, I think a good way to start this conversation is Austin and I have thrown around this term that I don't even know if it's a real term that I'm still trying to figure out. We've talked about this idea of post-cynical. And one thing that I'm seeing in the news, in the news people say it's such and such happened, that therefore, we're taking control of the narrative. And people mean by that is that let's say an event happened, but it seems that the news media or people in general, when they say that, we're taking control of the narrative, they're not really concerned about reality. They're just concerned about the level of reality that we all operate on, which is this kind of media saturated hyper reality. And to me, this is so cynical, that we really are at a place in society where we don't even try to get at the truth anymore. It's just that, okay, can we manipulate truth or package truth in a way to where we can advance our own agendas? It's not even that the idea of manipulating the narrative or pushing certain narratives, it's not even something that people in smoky rooms, manipulate. It's that it's just out in the open now. We're all just okay with the fact that reality is gone. There are only these prepackaged narratives that we essentially just brainwash people into.
Well, I think that we're aware of the real reality and that we're all lying to ourselves basically, but it's almost like a game at this point. It's like, all right, there are sides and you are on one side and that the public at large, we all feed into we all buy into the narrative, but we also all accept that it's not how it should be, I feel like, or at least a lot of people do. Maybe.
All right.
What do you think, Austin? What's your take?
This is for Irish Ray on Twitter, who complained about my utter wanky nonsense. I'm about to get utter wanky and nonsensical here.
Let's get wanky, baby.
Should we get wanky before I just spell out basically what we're talking about in the context of the movie before you get too wankified?
Okay, yeah, do that.
So I've got it written down. So okay. Basically, this movie. So let's talk about how it is in the media. So in this way, the story is in a lot of ways about control, and the most pivotal type of control that you can have is control over the narrative. So the film basically shows how a well-constructed narrative can prevail over reality in a way that things seem are more important than how they are. people are unwilling or unable to discern the truth in favor of a palatable narrative. So this is done a couple ways in the film. So one, the characters are reduced to consumable narratives. So there's a really memorable part in the movie. Actually, there are a whole bunch of just one-liners in the movie where people are saying things like, oh, she's wearing, why is she dressed like a babysitter? Or there's the part where a neighbor says, she's talking about Amy, seems like a rich bitch to me, spoiled rich girl married a cheating asshole. You know, this idea of the spoiled rich girl that married a cheating asshole, that is a narrative that, because we've all watched television, we've all seen the news, this is so ingrained in us that when we see a person that we don't even know, but they seem to fit some elements of that familiar narrative, we will just pigeonhole that into it because it becomes more consumable and palatable for us to do so. And this is essentially the entire conflict of the movie, is that Amy is able to manipulate public perception by creating and curating this reality that makes it seem like that Nick is falling into the narrative traps of being an abusive husband, of being someone who resents her, of being someone who wants to take her money and, you know, wants to basically just cheat on her and abscond with his 20-year-old girlfriend after taking all of her money, and that he's a murderer, all these things. And so basically the movie is saying, and there's just, it's all over this movie. This movie is so subtle in all of its executions of this. And I can talk for the rest of the movie, but that's basically what we mean. It's not only in the conflict of Amy constructing this narrative that ultimately almost puts Nick in jail, but also that her life is mostly been constructed not only by her parents, who are always comparing her to the amazing Amy character, but also that she's always, her identity is always being kind of crushed by men in her life, whether it's Desi, who once she takes refuge in his house, he wants to construct her in his image. You know, he wants her to start working out again because she had gained a little bit of weight when she decided she was going to kill herself. And so he's like, no, you got to go back to being your real self, which is the super hot skinny girl. I'll let Austin start wanking. Go ahead, bro.
Well, so there's a philosopher named Byung-Chul Han, who I've been really interested in, I'd say, for the past couple of months. And one of the things he talks about is that in this stage of late capitalism or postmodernism or neoliberal capitalism, whatever you want to call the epoch that we are currently in right now, he says that everything becomes a consumable image. And it's a consumable image based on some sort of projected fantasy that derives from ourselves, which means that nothing is really ever other, nothing is really ever traumatic. There's no what he calls negativity. And what he means by that is basically just something that would challenge us or transform us. Everything just becomes a consumable image for our own pleasure seeking, that we are these, he calls us achievement subjects. We're constantly trying to improve on ourselves or make ourselves better. And this leads to what he calls the burnout society in one of his books. But the idea is that everything is this consumable commodity, and it doesn't just mean like the food that you actually eat, but even the media images that we consume, let's say in our intellectual or like our epistemic encounter, in order to derive some sort of satisfaction. And even if it's like we hate watch Love Island because we want to make ourselves feel better, or 16 and Pregnant or whatever it is, there's still in our hate watching or in our Twitter fighting or in our social media arguments that we have with the random evangelical person that's a creationist, all of that is still an element of this pleasure seeking within what he calls this hyperactive era of positivity. And I think that's something that we see on display in this film, is that all of these consumable images, they exist because of what Marx would call real subsumption. And real subsumption is the phase of capitalist development where capital no longer is something that's existing outside trying to accumulate things, but it literally becomes the embedded logic of everything, because everything is a commodity. Everything is something that is there for your viewing pleasure or for your consumable pleasure. And I think that's one of the things that is quite fascinating about what this film is exploring with regards to the media, which is all a profit-driven thing, right? So it's going to sensationalize, and all these people are camping out in front of the house because they want to attract more eyeballs so that they can charge higher rates on for their advertisers. So all of that, I think, is something that Fincher's exploring and playing with. And I think in that sense, it's very fascinating.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So it sounds like we're on the same page.
That doesn't mean I like the movie. I just think it's fucking fascinating. I mean, you know, I can make the distinction.
No, of course. Of course. I mean, I guess Whereas you are probably very well versed in these ideas before watching the movie. For me, I kind of movies are kind of my introduction into philosophy,
and then I find the thinkers later.
You know what I'm saying? So when I watched this movie, this was like somebody almost putting into words what I had been thinking my whole life about how, you know, reality is just not even important anymore, and that you're right, that reality will be formed to what is most sellable.
Yeah. I mean, there's something so brilliant about what film is. I think, and here's the thing too, for people listening that are interested in philosophy and some of the stuff that we constantly talk about, film is a way of thinking that is independent from philosophy. We can do like philosophy of film, but there's this brilliant philosopher named John Malarkey who wrote a book on film. He's a film theorist in London, and it's called Refractions of Reality. And one of the things he talks about is that film isn't something that's reducible to something that we can just simply philosophize about. Sure, we can, but film itself is a type of thinking that articulates something independent that philosophy can't articulate. And thinking from film or with film, which is kind of, I think, what you're talking about, Jared, is something that is a unique and valuable sort of endeavor in itself.
All right, I don't want to – so, Claire, what do you think?
So there's been so many things that have been touched on that I have thoughts about all of them. So I want to maybe go roll back a second to the post-cynicism that you mentioned earlier. And yeah. I think that really kind of struck my ear as you said it, because for me, one of the things that makes Gone Girl both as a book and as a movie so poignant is its place in the genre of domestic noir. And for those of you who aren't familiar, domestic noir has been around for a long time, but it is having a really recent resurgence. And it's noir films that focus on the home and marriages and the family as sources of deep conflict, and all of the kind of sexuality and cynicism and mistrust and things that you see in traditional noir, those taken and put into a domestic setting where they're so aptly used by so many excellent writers and filmmakers. So
it's like Double Indemnity would probably be a classic one, right?
I think so, yeah. Rebecca, Alfred Hitchcock, and I someone on the writer's chat mentioned that one. I hadn't even remembered that. Some of the more recent books you might have heard of are Paula Hawkins' Girl on a Train, A.S.A. Harrison's The Silent Wife.
Girl with a Dragon Tattoo?
Well, she has more settings than that. And she's not married or anything.
I'm not sure that one's domestic noir as involved, much, but yeah, okay, it pulls on a lot of similar themes. But one of the things with classic noir that definitely extends to domestic noir is cynicism. And the that approach to the environment, to relationships, is what gives it part of that punch. And half of you went to film school, you know so much more about the genre of noir than I do, but it seems like that fits in really closely with any discussion we'd have about cynicism within Gone Girl.
So when you kind of read this as a development of that, do you see it as the cynicism directed toward just relationships in general? And speak to the movie specifically if you can, because I know that in terms of relationships, there's a little bit different in the book. But or is it mostly in how the media has affected the domestic situation, or is it I guess I'm wondering, are there two separate ideas here? Is it how the media affects narrative and just how we as a society have somehow evolved into consuming narrative in a certain way independent of media?
So I actually think that the media relations in the movie are one of the least interesting things about it.
Are we just too basic?
No, not at all. It seems like they're the things that give it weight and believability. Like the character who's basically Nancy Grace. What's her name? She's played by Minnie Driver.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. She says almost word for word what Nancy Grace would say in a situation like that. And of course, all of the controlling the narrative and the way that Nick has to get, you know, his lawyer to throw gummy bears at him to get him to say the right thing so he's likable on screen. all of that's really important to kind of drive home how relevant and this is in this particular place and time. But I think that the cynicism, the relationships, that is more about these characters who are stories in themselves.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that it's not the media's approach to Amy or to Nick or to Margot that's so interesting to me. It's our relationship to them. They're not people, they're stories. And
right.
We have very particular expectations for those kinds of stories that are, you know, rolled up into these characters. And when those stories don't pan out the way that we expect them to, it unsettles us. And it's that unsettling that is what makes Gone Girl one of my favorite books and now movies. But I think that the characters as stories, as narratives, rather than as people, is something that's really independently interesting, regardless of the media aspect, which honestly is something that I hadn't spent too much time thinking about the way that the media related, because it just seemed like it was such a given that that would be part of how the story unfolded.
Oh, so you're telling me I'm basic. I see. No, I'm
kidding.
No, it's cool. But no, I totally hear what you're saying. So like, I think, yeah, you're right. Like, even if we take the media element out of the movie entirely, there's still that, like, even Nick, in order to woo Amy, has to act in a way. He's putting on a performance. The way that Nick has to act is, everyone is basically just a series of labels and narratives that we have to fit into because we want to project a certain image onto somebody, and we're aware that people think in narratives. So, you know, Nick wants Amy to think of him as, you know, the salt of the earth, pull yourself up by your bootstraps guy who is a perfect foil to her, you know, East Coast elitism or whatever. All right. So one thing I want to bring to our attention is there's something very self-aware, and there's one line that I really like in this movie. So Ben Affleck's character owns a bar called The Bar, and the cop even says, "Oh, I love The Bar." Very meta. And in general, in this movie, there's kind of this relentless self-awareness, like even in the most romantic part of the movie, which, because we're kind of dealing with an unreliable narrator, we don't even know if it actually happened or not. I think we can assume that it did, but this is when they're going through the sugar storm and he says, "I can't let you go through a sugar storm without getting a kiss." And even like this, it's not, there's nothing spontaneous about it. It's like that they look and recognize that we are in a romantic setting, therefore we need to follow the narrative or the motions of romance. And so my question for you guys, philosophers, and for the love of God, please make it concise. Are we, is this the nightmare of living in hyper-reality? Like, are we performing in order to adhere to certain kind of compacted references to some other reality?
Well, according to hyper-modernity and what Jean Baudrillard says in The Mirror of Production, okay, I'm done.
I think there's... what's terrifyingly relevant about the movie is that at the beginning, when they're meeting, I think they're meeting for the first time, when they're walking through the, what is it, like an art gallery, you know, and they're
they meet at a party.
Okay, at that party. They're having a very self-aware conversation, you know, a very she's being the cool girl and he is just, he's keeping up with her and they're going back and forth. And yeah, they're supposed to be, oh yeah, we're above this art scene, you know, because we really know what's going on and
stuff.
Well,
they introduced the idea of kind of typecasting people or kind of marginalizing people into these narratives. So Nick,
yeah,
they're looking at other people in the party and Nick says, "I don't see you sitting around quietly," or there's this guy here, he's sitting around quietly as he bloviates on his post-grad thesis about Proust, or the ironic hipster that's so self-aware he makes everything a joke. And then she's like, "Well, what type of guy are you?" And he said, "The corn-fed salt of the earth Missouri guy."
Right. And then flash forward to the very end of the movie and they've totally become like they have absorbed this idea of the labels to a hyper degree, and you know that is their life, that is their reality, you know, they live only in the label world, and that whole self-aware thing is still there, but you know, they're not outsiders anymore, they're totally inside the system.
See, doesn't this bug you a little bit that the way that they bond is just based on them being mean? Like, I don't know. Maybe I'm just in a stage right now where I just want people to be nice to each other a little bit or something. But
well, that's what the movie's about. It's like cynical.
That's kind of also like, you know, introductory flirting. You know, it's like a strong move, right? You know, like kind of being a dick. Isn't that what they say you should do?
Yeah.
Negging?
yeah, exactly. But they're not negging each other. They're negging everybody else. And then like standing on top of the bodies that they have just conquested together. You know?
Come on, Austin. Like, Austin, tell me you've never made a friend by bonding over how much you hate the rest of the people around you.
I have, and it's not something that I think is a great habit. But this,
really,
of course.
I think that it really just doesn't get any better than that.
I really feel like David Fincher's making a much wider point because he's a super bright, you know, self-aware guy, and he, like, everyone has become those people off in the corner making fun of the rest of society, it feels like. You know, that's like become a very mainstream thing. Yeah, I don't know. Am I the only person that feels that way?
What is the point you're saying?
The point I'm making is that it's kind of a critique of, I feel like, a trend through, I don't know, like how the subculture became the main culture, and how, you know, the subculture used to be, oh, we're the outsiders, we're trying to, you know, we're doing our own thing off of, you know, side of the status quo, and here we are. Now everyone kind of is Amy and Ben Affleck in the movie, at least in popular culture now.
In that they think that they're outside.
It's just so self-aware. It's so, you know, everyone is aware of the labels. Everyone's aware of people being aware of the labels. And, you know, it goes on and on down the rabbit hole. And so, yeah, that's...
But it's not only that, but the people that he's referring to when he says, oh, this guy looks like a blowhard who talks about his post-grad thesis about Proust. I mean, that guy is dressed in a certain way, probably to evoke, or to basically just like peacock to whoever might want somebody who bloviates about Proust.
Or he's being ironic, which is kind of
To Austin's point, that you're still commodifying yourself in order to, you know, optimize your value in some sort of a market.
Sure. Yeah, we talked about this. I don't even remember which episode it was, but where everyone in it is dressed a certain way. Oh. Interestingly, because Claire tweeted about that she was listening to it, the Devil Wears Prada episode. And we were like, oh, but Anne Hathaway's character, you know, she's not dressed according to the dictates of fashion. But Meryl Streep clearly says, no, you are dressed a certain way so that you can project a particular image, even in your kind of like
schlumpy
clothes.
You can't escape it.
Right.
You can't escape it. So let's talk about the title. I think that this is, I mean, for someone who's read the book a bunch of times, it's probably pretty obvious to you.
Gone Baby Gone Girl.
Gone Baby Gone Girl.
I got so confused because when you said we were doing this, I thought we were doing Gone Baby Gone.
I haven't seen that movie in a long time.
It's low to mid shelf Ben Affleck.
It's a better movie. It's a much better movie.
Ben Affleck directorial?
Yeah.
No.
He directed that movie. Whatever. Okay. So the title Gone Girl not only refers to the disappearance of Amy's physical self, but that her personality has been negotiated. So. This is one of the most interesting things here is that her identity, I mentioned this earlier, but her identity is always being compromised by who she's trying to please and who is trying to control her. So throughout her childhood, she's always struggling to live up to the, quote, amazing version of her that her parents created with all those kids' books. There's a great line where she's like, when I was 10, I quit cello. In the next book, Amazing Amy became a prodigy. Mm. And then Nick is like, you played volleyball? She's like, I got cut. She made varsity. So even as an adult, Amy's parents try to kind of transform her into this fictionalized version. There's a part where Amy's mom is like saying, at that same party, she's like, I thought you were going to wear white to match the wedding theme. And even the whole wedding, Amazing Amy is at that party when Nick, proposes to her it's a party celebrating that Amazing Amy, the character, is getting married. And I think that that's like particularly tragic because, he's like the romance, like we're supposed to think that it's a super romantic scene when he's going there and he's kind of performing. But not only that, like it's only like they're performing for an audience because literally there are these other reporters there who are interviewing her about her life. And there's like this extra relevance to the fact that, oh my God, just as Amazing Amy's getting married, so too is Amy. This is such a palatable narrative, but we don't really care about the reality between these two personalities or this couple is. It just doesn't matter. And look, man, like everyone, the reason why I think this movie is so amazing because everyone has to perform today to fit into some kind of narrative. And especially when you're on YouTube, I mean, it's fucking doubly so for, you know, for people like me. So, I mean, this it's understandable why this movie would resonate with me so much.
Do people ever come up to you on the street and go, hey, disembodied Jared?
It's happened a couple times.
Or embodied Jared.
Yeah.
And then they said, my perception of you was different.
And yeah, I'm like, what do you want to do, man? Yeah. Yeah, usually I just try to cut the conversation short so I don't bust the illusion.
We've all seen the headlines in the news of how someone lost their life in an act of cold-blooded murder. And while it's sad and grabs your attention, most people go on with their day without giving it another thought. But have you ever stopped to think about the life of the person at the center of the news story? They were more than just a headline or a statistic. They were someone's loved one or friend. I'm Mike Morford, and my podcast, The Murder of My Family, dives into some of those stories to help listeners get to know the person who was lost and how their death affected those closest to them. Listen to The Murder of My Family everywhere you listen to podcasts. There are well over 100 episodes to binge on now.
All right, as soon as there's anything else I wanted to bring up.
Oh, well, Gone Girl, the title.
Oh, yeah, no, I was just talking about that.
Yeah.
Oh, but if you want to, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I do. So I think that it's important also that it's not Gone Woman, and that's not just for alliterative purposes. I mean, Gone Woman would be a terrible book title, but it's very intentionally Gone Girl. And yeah, that's because most of the way that we see Amy, except for the end, actually including the end, but except for the part where she is at that trailer or somewhere kind of controlling her life, and except for the parts where we're hearing her through her diary, we're seeing Amy through the lens of the Nancy Grace character on TV, through her parents, through these like the vigils where she's the consummate victim, where it's incredibly infantilizing. And this is one of the places where I do think that the insight into the media is really interesting, the way that it points a spotlight on how we lap up victim narratives, especially about like young, beautiful white women. No, young, beautiful white girls. And so if she were older, or if she were, you know, a woman of color, or if any of these things were different, there wouldn't be this national, like every time you turn on the television, this is what you get, spotlight on the victim of Amy Dunn. And it's her as the victim, that's the Gone Girl. It's not the Amy Dunn that we know for real that's the Gone Girl, except maybe also in the double sense of what you said earlier about her personality being vacated in lieu of the cool girl or whatever someone else wants to see in her. But my point is that the girl aspect is part of the take on our obsession with these victims of these young, pretty white girls. And I think that that's really important to include in any kind of discussion about the title.
Yeah. You know, the misogyny thing is definitely more present in the book, where Ben Affleck's dad, or it's not Ben Affleck in the book, but Nick Dunn's father, you know, that he often, Nick or Amy, I don't remember from which perspective in the particular chapters in the book, will often talk about how the father was a huge misogynist and he would always say horrible things about the mother being a dumb bitch. And there are parts in the book where Amy kind of refers to herself in a semi-ironic fashion of being the poor dumb bitch. And it's funny how I totally agree that the girl thing is super relevant, and I like the way that you put it, especially when we see, you know, like her face on billboards and stuff like that, and how, you know, And that's another reason why I think that this works so well as a movie, because just seeing the image of beautiful Rosamund Pike on a billboard through screens, we really do get it really does convince us and show us how, like, yeah, just as everyone in the movie is hypnotized by the media going crazy over this beautiful woman that's missing, we can almost see that happening because we have that same kind of gut reaction where when we see a beautiful white girl on a billboard, you know, we're just like, oh my God, that's not real. That's not how reality works. This is wrong.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and God, yeah.
There's one particular, almost like really insignificant moment that just reminded me of, but that I think has is really significant is when we see her on the billboard, it's a digital billboard and it's flipping from some other thing. And you can see, or maybe it's not digital, but it's one of the billboards that, you know, rolls over. And whatever was on the billboard before, we see it in the process of rolling over to show, you know, the new thing of the day.
Right, just some other ad.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. And it's that rolling over process, which I think was one of those little touches that makes me love this movie so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and that's just kind of the visual medium. You can do something super subtle and super clever like that, which is more to Austin's point, is like even a horrible thing like a woman missing is just a commodified narrative that sells well on billboards and sells well on television.
This is literally making me feel sick. Like, this is so it's so interesting. This is what, you know, how I always say, like, I don't always need to love a film, but I can still find it to be so impactful or insightful. This is interesting.
Oh, the another thing that points, like, another subtle visual thing is the score. I guess it's not a visual thing, but the audio thing is the score really adds to the satirical element at the end, especially when she's like, telling Ben Affleck, like, look, you're going to do this. You're going to be my loving husband, you know, and it's just this swelling score that, like, it's almost like supposed to be like, wow, I agree with her. It's almost like what the movie's saying, you know, when really you're like, wait, this is fucked up what she's trying to get him to do right now.
Right. And I love the scene of, like, you know, when now Amy and Nick are on the same page and they know that they have to manipulate the media, and they see all the media cars outside.
Yeah.
And right before they walk, they go out of their house, they like turn and wave at the cameras, almost just like Miss America, because they're giving the people what they want. They're giving them the end of the story, what they want. But at the end, you know, we have a very cynical ending, and that is that kind of the hyper reality or the narrative supersedes reality, because Amy has trapped him and he is ensnared in the narrative because he can't break up with her, or else he'll be basically crucified.
Yeah, this is why I love Carrie Coon's character so much. She's my favorite character in the movie. I mean, first of all, she's the sister. I mean, I think she's a brilliant actor. If you guys haven't seen The Leftovers,
she's the voice of reason.
Margo,
yeah.
I mean, she is fucking amazing. So her performance is phenomenal. But also, I like the fact that she is the voice of reason, you know? And I actually would be really curious, Claire, that character in the book, is that character, like, represented similarly? What do you think of that character?
I honestly can't remember, which makes me think that it probably was pretty similar. But I think that you're right, that just how well the actress plays Margot in the film version, her sitting slumped against the cabinets as she says, I can't watch you do this for 18 years. And it slowly dawns on her that part of Nick wants to be with Amy, and just the devastation, seeing this devastation played out on the face of the person who's the voice of reason is something so much more powerful than you could get in a book, no matter how good the character was. And it's interesting because she's not the straight man exactly. Like, it's not that she is a stand-in for the audience that sees things clearly, like the way that a straight man would be in a comedy. She's something else, but... Mm. And she's not exactly an audience stand-in, but she does have this very particular role of helping us make that jump between reality and what we're seeing, so that it's understandable, so that we can palate it, but still share with her kind of the horror of what we're seeing.
Mm. Yeah. So in the book, so when we did the Thug Notes episode on the book, we have like meticulous notes that I actually reviewed before this recording, but in the book there's a quote where Nick says that Margot is his confidant, that he doesn't need to perform around, that he can be his real self. So she plays a very interesting role when we consider the idea of unreliable narrators, because he at least tells the audience that whenever I'm with Margot, I'm not performing. And if we're meant to believe that, then she does play a pretty interesting role, in that we can believe that there is no performance when he's around Margot. That's reality. That is the reliable narrator, at least if we're to go with what he says. One more thing I wanted to bring up. I hadn't noticed this before. This is another kind of small detail that I had not realize, I had not picked up on previous ones, but the male cop who you can easily forget about. It's not the main cop. I can't remember her name, but it's the guy who kind of follows her and like who really doesn't like Nick. And I was really picking up on that this time. And I think it's because, you know, this guy, he...
Beta male.
He looks at Nick.
Did you just
and he,
call him
and, you
know, a beta?
He looks at... The male cop hates him because... He's a lazy, good-looking social climber, you know, whereas the cop is like, I've been living in Missouri my whole life and I'm not good and I didn't, you know, move to New York and bag myself a trust fund hottie and come back
right.
and get
it's
a
resentment.
Mansion and just be lazy my whole life.
Resentment.
Yeah, there's like this real resentment. Yeah. But he doesn't even know Nick. It's just that, what is, okay, he's a soy boy, bro.
He feels like a pushover because his wife pushes him over. He's got to go do familial responsibility things. Nick, Ben
well,
Affleck,
we don't know that.
Big, strong, gets whatever he wants. Yeah, he's resentful.
I don't think it's so much that. It's just that it's, well, there's also, you know, but this goes both ways, and that is that Nick is constantly humiliated because he's not fulfilling the narrative of the breadwinner.
Mm. Yeah, but the cop doesn't know that.
No, the cop doesn't know that, but the cop doesn't care because the cop just sees, like, I don't like this guy. All I know is the kind of the bullet points of him. He, you know, moved to New York, married a rich girl, came back, and now he's rich and he never did anything for it. So fuck him. He must be a killer.
Mm. I see a lot of parallels between the way that you're describing that male cop and the way that... I don't remember her name, but the kind of friend who ends up stealing her money, Amy's money at the first place she stays, the way she makes that casual comment about, rich bitch, you know, like married this guy, like whatever. I don't have any sympathy for her. She's making these claims about or these assumptions about how this woman in this situation is supposed to be and how we should judge her based on that, whereas the male cop is doing something kind of analogous, I think, in a way, with his very quick assumptions and dislike of Nick. And I don't know if I'm making a good analogy here. What do other people think?
No, yes. I hear you. Yeah, absolutely. Well, she says something similar, when she's watching with Amy, an image of Amy, she's just like, fuck that, you know, beautiful white girl on a billboard. Just from this image, you can tell that she's probably just gotten everything handed to her whole life.
Yeah, there's some class resentment again, maybe.
Yeah, class is narrative in a sense.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah. All right, well, we're going to wrap it up there, guys. Thank you guys so much for joining us. Before we leave, reminder, if you guys want to support what we do, I highly recommend checking out wisecrackplus.com. We have our newest pilot on there. Also, Ryan has a new pilot that we're actually going to be submitting to our patrons first. So if you want to check that out, it should be up probably tomorrow. So hit that up at wisecrackplus.com.
Let's get stupid. Are we allowed to say the name?
Oh, yeah, if you want to talk about it.
Let's get stupid rich. It's an investment show where, I don't know. Just watch it,
Ryan,
I say.
Are you like the crazy Ryan, Kramer dude that's on Fox or whatever channel?
You mean Mad Money?
It's Mad like Mad Money meets Wayne's World.
Yeah, I would say that. All right, guys, where can we find you on the internet, starting with Claire?
You can find me on Twitter at WisecrackClaire. Made it easy for you.
And Ryan?
You can find me on YouTube and Facebook at Ryan Shorts. And Ryan's Game Show. I love you all very much.
Mm-hmm. And Austin.
You can hit me up on Twitter, Austin_Hayden. I also do a philosophy podcast called Owls at Dawn. And then another movie podcast that's not wanky and philosophical. So, you know, if you hate my wankiness and philosophicalness, you can just hear me talk about like acting and performance with a director friend of mine in London. It's called I Dig This Movie.
So you're telling me you saved the wanks for here?
Yeah, man,
Thank you, man.
I know my role.
We appreciate it.
Right? I am an embodied, commodified, disembodied image of wankiness.
Well, you'll be in LA soon, so we'll embody your wankiness. But just,
deal.
That sounds like it could be potentially disgusting. Anyway, that's it for today, guys. See you later. Peace.
Goodbye from Hollywood, California.
Laters.
Bye.